What is going on, everybody? What is going on? It's your boy Nye, and welcome to another episode of What is Crypto, the podcast where we talk a little bit about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the future of our financial systems. Just a disclaimer, guys, this is not financial advice. I am not a financial advisor. We are not here to give you any financial advice. This is specifically for entertainment and education purposes only. Finally, guys, if you want to ask a question specifically to me as the host or any of the guests, you can go over to our Facebook group and you can drop a question in the Facebook group. You can learn more about the Facebook group as well as our Patreon and other information hubs that we have for What is Crypto at whatiscrypto.com. Today, I've got a really special guest on the line. I have Jameson Lopp. Jameson is a Bitcoin engineer, and he's also the chief technology officer of the crypto startup Casa. Jameson is also very notable for his decision to live off-grid, which is really cool. It's been written about in the New York Times and other places. Today, Jameson and I are sitting down to talk about Bitcoin. We are giving you the 101 on what Bitcoin is, including the origin story of Satoshi and how the Bitcoin white paper came into existence. We talk a little bit more about who we think Satoshi is, why Bitcoin was created, and specifically why it's important and how it works. All right, guys, let's listen to what Jameson has to say. Awesome, Jameson. Thank you again for so much for coming on. Can you just give us a little introduction of yourself? What is your name and your title?
Sure. My name is Jameson Lopp. My title is CTO of Casa.
Awesome, man. And how would you describe yourself?
Ooh, that's a tricky one, but I think I'll have to go with what my goal in life is these days, which is I am someone who is technical and is trying to use my technical abilities to improve the privacy and freedom of people around the world.
What is Bitcoin to you? Can you tell a little bit about the history, the origins, Satoshi, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is this experiment, this grand open project that is trying to be, I guess, the optimal form of money. It's very broad from a philosophical standpoint because it has many different aspects to it. And this results in people arguing about all kinds of different parts of how it actually operates. I mean, it involves everything from game theory to cryptography to computer networking to economic and monetary theory. And it's very hard to talk about comprehensively simply because it's at the intersection of all of these things. I started out looking at Bitcoin as a technology, and over the years, I've come to believe that it's actually this like cultural paradigm shift in thinking and completely different form of governance that seems to be a lot more interesting than just the technology. The technology is just something that allows us to operate this completely new system that's very hard to define. But you know, it's over 10 years old now, and it just appeared out of nowhere on the Cypherpunk mailing list by this anonymous individual or possibly group of people that called themselves Satoshi Nakamoto. And they basically said, hey, we've found a way to solve this famous problem in computer science, which is the Byzantine generals problem. And that problem basically says, you know, if you have a group of actors that is distributed and they're trying to coordinate plans to attack a city, how are they able to do that if their communication between each other could get corrupted by basically bad actors or enemies that are trying to screw up their ability to coordinate the attack? And this also ended up solving a fundamental problem within distributed financial systems, which is how do you prevent somebody from spending the same money twice, which tends to be pretty easy to do if you're talking about digital money, because you can basically copy and paste data very quickly, very easily. So Satoshi basically created this protocol that it put together a lot of other building blocks from a technological standpoint that had existed for a while, but Satoshi put them together in a way that had never been done before and created this new peer-to-peer network that was able to withstand various attacks and basically secured itself by having each actor on the network validate all of the data, and by having other actors on the network expend a provable amount of energy that would then make it very expensive for anyone to try to roll back the history of what had happened on the network.
And who do you think this Satoshi person is or was, or the group of Satoshi?
Yeah, at this point, given that Satoshi has managed to disappear and remain silent and never be found for, I think, nearly 8 years now, it seems more and more likely that Satoshi may have passed away. Otherwise, Satoshi is probably one person, because, I mean, you know, the more people that you have involved in something, the more difficult it is to keep a secret. And the best way to keep a secret is if everybody involved is no longer alive. You know, it was probably someone or some people who were early cypherpunks, but not necessarily. I tell people that, as far as I know, it's just as plausible that Satoshi could be a random, you know, teenager in Asia who just stumbled upon some of these technologies. You know, it could even be, if you want to go more far out there, it could be a advanced artificial intelligence from the future that came back and basically invented a new monetary system that it could use to enrich itself in the future. Who knows? The only thing that we really know is that it seems like Satoshi has not been interested in actually making use of the billions of dollars that has essentially enriched them from those early blocks that they mined. And, you know, that is a level of restraint that I believe has never been seen before. And it's, you know, it's so hard to believe that someone who is still alive would be able to exhibit that level of restraint, unless perhaps they are so afraid of the consequences that trying to spend that money would reveal their identity and make them a target of some very powerful people.
And there's a lot of actors in the space, some that are very popular in terms of having a lot of attention, and others that are not, that come forth and claim to be Satoshi. For people that are listening to this for the first time and hearing about Bitcoin for the first time, what warning would you give people for some of the other actors out there that make this claim?
You have to understand that it would be incredibly simple for the real Satoshi to provide hard cryptographic evidence that is publicly verifiable. There are some people, for example, Charlie Lee, the creator of Litecoin, actually provided proof that, you know, he created the Genesis block by, you know, signing messages cryptographically with the private keys that were related to the Coinbase of the Genesis block. If we assume that Satoshi didn't lose their keys, which I think is actually a pretty good assumption, because Satoshi actually had quotes where they said, you know, you should never delete a wallet, you should never delete private keys, then it stands to reason that the real Satoshi would be able to retrieve those keys and sign, you know, arbitrary challenges to essentially prove in real time that they are the creator of the system. So the various people who have come out and claimed to be Satoshi have provided no such cryptographic evidence. And at least one of them has actually provided invalid, obviously fraudulent and faked cryptographic evidence on multiple occasions. So there's really no reason to believe that anyone to this day who has claimed to be Satoshi is actually being honest.
I want to give a big shout out to our first sponsor, and our first sponsor is Celsius Network. They are doing some really, really cool stuff, trying to revolutionize the way we think about the financial world and financial services. Celsius offers 10% annual interest on all crypto deposits, and there's no secret to how they're doing it. That 10% comes from them sharing 80% of their profits rather than the 0.00001% that banks choose to share. Celsius is giving each user $10 in Bitcoin when they make their first 200 deposit or more in crypto or stablecoins when they use the promo code NYE. These guys are working hard to revolutionize the way we look at the financial world, and they're taking on the banks. I'm personally a huge fan of what Celsius is building, so dive over to celsius.network to learn more and to use promo code NYE in order to get $10 in BTC when you make your first deposit of $200 or more. Shout out to our sponsor, B21. B21 is a mobile app and a crypto on-ramp to invest in cryptocurrency assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. It is your personal wealth manager for all your crypto assets. The goal with B21 is that it allows you to invest in a few clicks. No more complex passwords, keys, wallets, or tech talk. Just set your goal, choose your crypto asset, and you are ready to go. B21 is easier than any trading platforms on the market today. You don't need any trading experience to get started or to get involved with cryptocurrency. You simply choose from the available coins and tokens, you set your investment goals, and you easily monitor all the progress. You can even set up reoccurring investments to draw from your bank or your debit card every single month. Head over to B21.io to join the waitlist. B21.io. Why was Bitcoin created?
Well, in the white paper, it basically states in the opening paragraphs that one of the fundamental problems with the financial system is that it currently relies upon a lot of trusted third parties. It's very difficult outside of using something like cash or gold, you know, physical objects, it's very difficult to engage in true peer-to-peer commerce where you're sending money directly to the counterparty without it being routed through some third party, if not multiple third parties. And the problem with these third parties is that they can arbitrarily decide to screw with your money. They may decide to censor your payments. For example, we have seen various payment companies that have censored payments or donations to political organizations such as WikiLeaks. They may also be pressured into not allowing you to store or send value if you have a business that is either illegal or possibly gray area. Some examples of that, for example, I think the cannabis industry in certain states in the United States where it's legal at the state level, but it's still illegal at the federal level. And of course, the feds get to pressure all the banks and tell them they better not help anyone deal with business funds that are resulting from what is now legal cannabis in those states. Or, you know, even other things like people in the sex industry, which is legal in some places, but not in others. It creates just additional complications because these third parties are essentially single points of failure. They're choke points that can cause your money to become less fungible, to basically become less valuable because you cannot do everything with it that you may want to do. But at a high level, the way that it works is that the system operates under the assumption that you should not trust anyone. You may hear people talk about trustlessness, or there's a motto, don't trust, verify. And this basically means that whenever you are receiving money or whenever you are sending money on the Bitcoin network, there are a variety of different security and privacy models that you can choose from. But the ultimate level of security within Bitcoin is one where you are validating yourself everything that is happening on the network. So you are running what we call a fully validating node or full node. And that is basically some software that is automating the downloading and the relaying of blocks and transactions on the network so that you have read and validated all of the rules of the protocol to make sure that no one is breaking the rules. And, you know, why would someone want to break the rules? Well, they might want to double spend their money. They might want to fool you into thinking they have sent you money when they actually have not. There are a variety of ways that this can be done, especially if you're not running a fully validating node, where you could be fooled into thinking that you had received money that you actually have not. But by operating in a system where everyone who is running a full node, and currently there is about 10,000 publicly available full nodes and close to 100,000, we believe, total full nodes, many of which are private and not reachable over the network directly. But everyone who is running one of these and is essentially having their wallet be backed by the full node, they are operating in a way that they know that no one is lying to them, because they are getting data from multiple other peers on the network and they are checking it. And if you receive any data that is invalid on the network, then you just throw it away. You don't have to assume that anyone is being honest to you, because you're checking all the rules and you can tell if someone is lying to you. And if another node is lying to you, you just disconnect from them and don't let them send you any more information. So that's a very high level of how the trust model works. And by operating in a system where you don't have to trust anyone, it is highly inefficient from a technical standpoint, but it gives you this level of security that we've never really seen before. Now, there's a lot of trade-offs there, and you end up with issues of privacy because, you know, all of the data gets sent to everybody on the network. You also end up with issues of scalability, which people have been arguing about for many years. But that is kind of the root issue, is that it has created a completely new model of trust, which some people call trustless. But, you know, there are certain assumptions that go into that. And I have some very, very long articles that go into detail about how that all works.
Briefly touch on mining, because we're going to have a full episode about mining. But how does mining work, and how does it contribute, or how does it function with the Bitcoin network?
Yeah, so the best way, I think, to look at mining as, you know, a participant on the network, is it is essentially acting as this time stamping function. So you have the nodes on the network, you have people who connect their wallets to the nodes, and they're creating transactions. When you create a transaction, you broadcast it to a few other peers that you're connected to, and then those peers validate the transaction. If it's valid, they rebroadcast it to their peers, and so on. And in that way, the transactions get broadcast across the network within a matter of seconds. Now, that's all good and well, but you get into this problem where on a decentralized distributed network, there is no guarantee of ordering. So it would be possible for someone to put a transaction onto like one edge of the network and then put a competing, conflicting transaction onto some nodes on the opposite side of the network. And then as they propagate across the network, some nodes think, you know, the first transaction is correct. Some nodes think the other transaction is correct. It's very hard to know what is correct if people are screwing around with the system like this, which is fairly easy to do because there are no gatekeepers. It's a permissionless system where you can connect to any node you want and send them any data you want. So how do we resolve that? Well, basically, you have to have some sort of almost a heartbeat or time stamping type of function that every so often it collects up the transactions and it puts them into the ledger, or in our case, the blockchain. So the miners, they're sitting out there on the network, they're running their own nodes, they're listening and gathering transactions, and they're basically batching them up and creating these containers that are called blocks. And the blocks have a few other attributes to them. One of the more interesting ones being that each block actually points to the unique ID or the hash of the previous block. And due to the way that hashes work, a hash is kind of like a fingerprint of all of the data that is being sent into the hash function. You are essentially creating this linked list of blocks that go all the way back in time to the Genesis block, the first one that was created by Satoshi. And by having them all linked together, it creates a level of auditability where you can very easily scan through all of the blocks and transaction data that ever happened. And that is what every node does as it is syncing. And it's not possible for an attacker to arbitrarily change any of the data in these blocks, because changing a single bit of data would then change the hash of that block in the fingerprint, and that would essentially break this link in the chain of blocks, because the next block would no longer be pointing at the same hash. So that blockchain aspect of the data gives us really strong auditability, which is kind of a proof against tampering, but it still doesn't make it expensive to tamper with. The way that we make it expensive for people to tamper with is that the miners are also doing something that is called proof of work, which basically means they are trying to brute force this function that is just trying to find a hash or an ID that has a certain number of leading zeros on it. The more leading zeros there are, the harder it is to find, because hashes are essentially random. It's not possible to predict what the hash of any given data is going to be. So it's a little more complicated to talk about like how proof of work is actually calculated, but suffice to say that the proof of work within Bitcoin corresponds to a function that is targeting new blocks being found approximately every 10 minutes. It's not always going to be 10 minutes because of the randomness that is involved, but as long as we're having blocks come out at fairly regular intervals, then we're continuing to extend the blockchain. We're continuing to put transactions into an ordered and timestamped format where we can have this additional level of assurance, which is basically a thermodynamic guarantee that so many, you know, dollars worth of energy were expended to create those blocks, that we basically know that if we receive a transaction and it's in the block, and then a certain number of blocks have been added after that, we can know mathematically that it's highly unlikely that that transaction is ever going to get reversed, because it would require, you know, a known amount of energy to be expended. And so that's why we say that, you know, unconfirmed transactions on this network should not be trusted for anything. And then basically, depending upon the value of how much money you are transacting, you should then wait an appropriate number of blocks before you send your counterparty whatever the other good or service that you're exchanging is.
And the media talks a lot about Bitcoin being used in ransom attacks, for illegal trades, for drugs, and even assassination payments. What other purposes does Bitcoin have?
Right. So, you know, Bitcoin is meant to be sound money. It's meant to be censorship resistant, which basically means that you should be able to send Bitcoin to anyone you want without fear of that payment being stopped. Much as we were talking about some of the problems with third-party payment processors earlier, that means that, you know, sound money is going to be valuable for people who are doing illegal things, or for people who are just doing things that are questionable. You know, they may not be illegal, but they may be considered unethical by some people. Just in anything that is controversial, like we said, it could even be politically controversial. And, you know, if we believe that money is a form of speech, then I think that, you know, free speech is something that we should be striving for. But this is a controversial idea in and of itself, because if you're going to be building a censorship-resistant financial network, then it means, by definition, you must not be able to stop your enemies from using that network. So that means that, you know, even terrorists should be able to use Bitcoin because there is no gatekeeper on the network that can stop them from doing so. Now, that doesn't mean that anyone can get away with anything. You know, there will still be plenty of, you know, law enforcement activity, and, you know, law enforcement has already been watching the Bitcoin network for some time and definitely brought down some criminals who were using it. So it does not mean that, you know, Bitcoin makes law enforcement irrelevant.
And in comparison to the US dollar and other fiat currencies, how does Bitcoin compare? And what role does it play in terms of the economic system of being this peer-to-peer currency or peer-to-peer digital cash that was the initial intention of Satoshi Nakamoto?
Well, at a high level, the biggest difference is the fact that the economic rules of how the supply will exist in the future are already determined. Whereas, you know, any other currency that is issued by central banks or nation states, you have no idea what they're going to do in the future because they make the rules and they can change them arbitrarily. If we're getting beyond just the economics, though, there are plenty of other issues on the scalability and privacy side where the most private form of financial interaction right now is just cash, you know, handing physical cash to someone. That is definitely still true. It's more private to do that than to do anything, you know, on the internet, even with cryptocurrencies. But the scalability problem is also a large issue because it's very easy to scale computer networks if you're just having everyone go through a single point. You can then have that central party basically scale up their hardware and software on their own. But when you're trying to scale a distributed network, it's a lot harder because of the diversity of different participants and their own hardware and the fact that you can't simply push a button and update the software. You actually have to convince people to manually upgrade their software because it's to their benefit for some reason. So there's a lot of trade-offs, but I think a lot of people who are interested in Bitcoin believe that the financial sovereignty, this new trust model, and the economic reliability of the rules outweigh some of these other issues of scalability and privacy, which a lot of us are optimistic will be solved in the long run.
And for really the final question to wrap it all up, is Bitcoin really the future of payments, or is it more of a store of value / wealth, or is it both?
It's very hard to answer questions like these because it really depends upon the perspective of each person and their situation. So as it stands today, I believe that, you know, Bitcoin as a sovereign store of value seems to be the predominant use case. A lot of people who are Bitcoin users live in first world countries that have very good access to financial infrastructure, and they generally do not have problems making payments. Now, there are some types of payments, like we've talked about, you know, controversial payments, where people in first world countries may find Bitcoin and other crypto assets as, you know, preferable for those particular uses because they're censorship resistant. Now, it gets more interesting when we start looking at countries that do not have good financial infrastructure or that have terrible economies. Take Venezuela or Argentina, possibly even Russia, that the people in these countries have issues, you know, both with the storing of value in their system and with making payments. So I believe that, you know, logically it makes sense that these disenfranchised people or underbanked people have a lot more to gain by adopting Bitcoin as their preferred monetary type. I think it gets trickier because people who are in such desperate situations, they may not have the time and the resources to basically learn about it and start adopting the system. It may even be difficult for them to get onboarded due to a variety of different reasons. So I think there's plenty of opportunity for us in general to reach out to those people and try to get them onboarded. But on the payment side, I think that it is going to require a lot more work, which is why we're seeing things on the second layer of the Bitcoin network. So be that Lightning Network or various side chains, which are trying to solve some of the scalability issues. There's still plenty of work to be done there. I've been running a business that has been shipping Lightning Network nodes around the world for almost a year now, and it has certainly improved a lot over the past year, but we can tell that, you know, there's still plenty of work to be done. Probably years and years of work to be done before it gets to the level of usability that's like a Venmo or a PayPal or what have you.
I love it, man. Thank you so much for coming on, Jameson. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, thank you for tuning in to the episode about what is Bitcoin. And a big, big thank you to Jameson for coming on the show today. I know he's a very busy guy and a lot of people want to have him on the show. So I appreciate him taking the time to come on. You know, I really enjoyed the way Jameson describes what Bitcoin is and tells the origin story. This guy is knowledgeable about Bitcoin. He's been around for a very, very long time in this industry and in this space. So what I want you to do today as your DYOR or your do your own research is I have a little bit of homework for you. I'd like to see you guys go on Google and search for either a video or an article about Bitcoin. I'd like to see you either read a full article about Bitcoin or watch a full video about Bitcoin. At the end of reading that article or watching that video, I want you to head over to our Facebook group and ask one specific question about something you don't understand. If you don't have Facebook, you can head over to our Twitter channel and you can tag us and ask a question about Bitcoin, one specific thing you don't understand, and we are going to answer those questions to the best of our abilities. Finally, guys, it would mean a lot to us if you could leave a rating, leave a review, and leave a comment on iTunes, and specifically subscribe on iTunes as well. We will catch you in the next episode. Peace.